Clayton. John Clayton.
Hey, Mom! I'm done with my segment!
This is the Coors Light Cold Hard Facts with John Clayton.
Brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light, Washington's most refreshing beer.
Now, here's a six-pack of questions.
We got John Clayton with us, and well, it's ticking down. I think we're about 2 weeks out from training camp's opening, which is really hard to imagine. And, John, we saw an accusation today regarding LeSean McCoy, and that is, I guess, a friend of one of his ex-girlfriends has said that he had been physical and had beat her before. LeSean McCoy has denied this. I guess this would mean the next step is probably we'll have an NFL investigation into what she said occurred.
Well, the investigation has already started, and I know that the police put out a statement today that they acknowledge that somebody broke into the girlfriend's house, and the friend was there, and even the girlfriend apparently was hit, and much worse on the girlfriend. And so it seemed like a very violent assault with a lot of different things happening. Now, they've not put any kind of charge in because they're doing the investigation. The NFL is doing the investigation, and LeSean said it's false, it wasn't him, but a very serious thing because, you're talking about domestic violence. You're talking about breaking into a house. I mean, you saw now the serious charges that were made against Brandon Browner in something that I guess could be considered to be a little, even very similar because they actually gave him an attempted murder charge. So, we'll see where this ends up going, but a very scary thing for a very talented running back and really one of the faces of the Buffalo Bills franchise.
I guess I might have misunderstood this. Is this something that happened recently? Because I think when I initially
last
read
night.
It,
actually,
I did misunderstand it. I didn't realize it was something that had just happened. So the police investigation into this is really just beginning to try and figure out what happened. And LeSean McCoy, we should be clear, has said that he is innocent, that he did not do this.
Right, and so we'll just have to kind of wait this out. But, yeah, it's on a fast pace, but at least the police came out very quickly and acknowledged the incident. They just didn't attach anything to it as far as who might have done it.
Okay, and also now we're hearing different things about the Brandon Browner case that you mentioned there, John. What's new in that accusation of Brandon Browner?
Pretty bad. He got about four charges on him, including attempted murder and very serious charges. And so he's in for a very tough time here to see where it's going to go. So, they did make the formal charges. I'm sure that he's in the process of coming in and, getting booked and all those different things. But, this one looks pretty bad.
Wow. Yeah, it seems like every year something like this happens, at this time of year. But is it just because it's slow news time, or what is it, John? Is it me? Am I just misremembering this, or does it always seem like the 2 weeks, right leading up to camp, right before camp starts, that a lot of this stuff starts to come out?
Well, usually there's more of it, but every time I've been saying this, I've been knocking on wood, and unfortunately there's no wood to knock on right now because in the month of June, no current player in the NFL was arrested, charged, indicted, or anything like that. It was very clean. So here it is. You get past the fourth. Marquise White, a cornerback for the Dallas Cowboys, he gets almost in a road rage incident. That was bad. Then you have – now, Browner, of course, is out of football, so he would not count. Then you have the LeSean McCoy thing. So you would have to imagine that this two-week period is one that everybody's got to watch out for. Again, it was the quietest June I have ever imagined because I chart these things, and if anybody wants to follow some of the things, they can go to the USA Today NFL database. I know the San Diego Union-Tribune has a database that acknowledges any arrest, and you'll see nothing for the month of June. But here it is. You've got two incidents to start off right after the fourth. And I guess, once the firecrackers start going on after the fourth and you're waiting for the firecrackers of training camp to start blasting, these things happen because players have time on their hands.
John, really strange story about A.J. Francis, a defensive tackle for the Giants. And I guess he spent a little bit of time here in Seattle, but he had his mom's urn, had the ashes from his mom in his suitcase in TSA, either in L.A. or New York. Apparently, when he was going, they were going through his baggage, they spilled some of the ashes. And so it led to a tweet from Francis, and he said, "Hey, you pieces of bleep at TSA, next time you bleeps feel the need to go through my mother's ashes for no reason, Make sure you close it back so her remains aren't spilled on all my clothes. The least you pieces of garbage can do is your bleeping job, he said in a tweet. And, you know, I don't even know what to make of this story, John, but A.J. Francis, boy, that's and TSA has apologized. And then today in another story said that didn't actually happen. So it's kind of a weird one there, John.
Yeah, it's a very weird one. And by the way, the things that you just read were probably the nicest things, because he continued tweeting and the words got worse and worse and worse as time went on. So when you look at the whole incident now, of course, the reason the TSA changed their story a little bit is that they had to go back and they had to review what they saw on the videotape to see, you know, how everything happened. And apparently, you know, the way that he had packed the urn was what triggered them to go check out and see what was in there. And I guess when they did that, it kind of bumped it open and things fell out. But he was trying to get back home to at least, you know, take some of those ashes and put it in a proper place. And that apparently goes. So you can see, you know, the emotion. I mean, first off, I mean, understanding, it's like A.J. Francis can be mad, but he also just lost his mom. I mean, he's got to be very emotional at this time. And, you know, he's not necessarily going to have some kind of instructions of how to pack the urn, but apparently what they did at TSA, they didn't see any kind of notification on it or any kind of identifying thing. They just saw this kind of weird-looking thing in there, and that triggered them to open it up and see where it is, and poof, there goes the urn. So just kind of a very bad experience for a guy that lost his mom.
He was with the Seahawks for a little bit. We interviewed him,
yeah.
Talked to him. He was an Uber driver in the off season.
Like he, oh yeah,
like
that's right.
He had a couple of different odd jobs that he had. That was one of the things that he had done. So really, really disappointing. It's really sad. And regardless of who's to blame, it's one of those questions of you can't sort of unring that bell. And it's almost immaterial at that point of, I mean, what are you going to do? Try and sue someone over, like, the fact that her ashes were spilled in his luggage is just really awful and sad.
Well, and like John said, you know, you can understand how he's going to be a little bit emotional having just lost his mom. That's tough. He was a nice kid.
He was. He did have, he also had a post on Twitter, which was, "Whoever just called me from the New York Post, I don't appreciate that. I don't want to talk to any media people about this." So as you could see that it was just getting, I mean, his emotions in expressing the frustration and anger at TSA was compounded. It kind of made this big story that now you've got reporters calling to ask him about his feelings about having his mother's ashes spilled. Like, it's just all sorts of bad.
Yeah, I mean, and again, to go through an emotional time like this and have something like that happening, and again, it's like, what kind of instructions are you supposed to have? I mean, you know, I guess maybe the best thing for him would have been to check the bag so it wouldn't have to go through TSA, but I mean, you just lost your mom, you're making arrangements to do different things when you get back to her home, and you're trying to do this, and you're trying to just make sure everything's right, and so you just, you know, grab it and take it and figure, I'm just going to go through TSA and get to the plane and boom, here you go. So probably in retrospect, he probably should have checked a bag and not have to worry about it. But again, in retrospect, how are you going to be thinking of these things? All you're thinking about is the one thing. You just lost your mom.
Yeah. Hey, John, this is the first I've heard anyway of the NFLPA filing a grievance against the NFL as far as the anthem policy goes. Tell us a little bit about that. And could they have done this a little bit earlier? I mean, I feel like it took them quite a while to react to that when most of us, when we heard the news, reacted right away.
Yeah, you would have to think that, because again, we all reacted the same. We thought it was a bad policy that the NFL came up with, a policy that said, okay, if you want to have any kind of protest, you stay in the locker room. If you come on the field to do anything, we're going to fine the team and they're going to fine you. So that's how we're going to handle it, which was a bad strategy. But you would have to think, I mean, I was at that meeting in May and they put that order in May. So to wait all the way to July probably is a little bit late, because if the idea is you want to have a dialogue with the league, well, then get it to them as quickly as possible, because now the clock is ticking. I mean, you know, what are we, three and a half weeks from games? And so, you know, they needed to get to them a little bit earlier, but I'm happy they did file the protest and the grievance, because it can get a dialogue going and maybe, just maybe, they can get to do the right thing. And the right thing, in my opinion, is take this off the docket, take it off the problem area. You just have the players in the locker room. They all come out after the national anthem. You know, you have the national anthem with the proper respect. That is all there, but you know, the league hasn't been smart enough to be able to figure that out, and the owners haven't been smart enough to figure that out. But at least there's going to be a dialogue. I don't know if the wait of 2 months was because they wanted to hear back from the league and says, oh, yeah, we'll talk to you, because at least in the press release, they did say there is going to be some kind of a dialogue, but there's also going to be a grievance. How long is it going to take to get the grievance hearing, and is it going to be able to be done before games? This is a little late, but I think it's the right way to do it.
Bruce Irvin tied a career high with 8 sacks last year, John, and new Raiders defensive coordinator Paul Gunther. He thinks that Irvin can get to 10 sacks or more this year. Do you agree with him?
I agree, yeah, because I think what you can see is that they were waiting on Mario Edwards to be the pass-rushing defensive end. And, you know, he's been fighting injuries and, you know, not really having a great career the first couple of years. And they have Bruce as a strong side linebacker, kind of like he was here, and then occasionally rushing. But now, if he's going to be their number two pass rusher, which it looks like he is, he does have the chance to go ahead and have a 10-sack season. I mean, you know, there's going to be a lot of coverage on Khalil Mack on the other side. He's going to get the double coverage. And usually, as Dave knows, I mean, if the one guy is going to get double-team coverage, that's single coverage. And single coverage on Bruce Irvin after an 8-sack season can lead to a double-digit sack. I mean, hey, the respect that he still gets is there. I mean, he was in the NFL top 100 as voted by players. That was encouraging. I thought maybe because of cap reasons he was going to be let loose and be available, but he wasn't. And I think you can see that John Gruden and Paul Gunther have a very valued position for what they want to do with him.
Do you think that Bruce Irvin, through his first 3 seasons with the Seahawks, was he as good as Frank Clark has been, or has Frank Clark been a more productive player to start his career with the Seahawks, John?
I think you have to lean a little bit more. I mean, the first two, in the second year, I think you have to give it to Frank Clark. But by the third year, I mean, Bruce was playing at a very high level, because, you know, he had now incorporated. But I think what you're looking at, and I think it's the nature of the game, and this goes to the point that, you know, it takes you 3 years of practice to equal 1 year of what Dave Wyman had as far as the number of practices. And what you're seeing is that, particularly in certain positions, and it could be the strong side linebacker who comes in and rushes the quarterback, it takes them really until the third year to really emerge. Now, I mean, you look at Bill Clark, he was able to start doing it by his second year as the number 3 pass rusher. But I think, you know, Irvin by year 3 was playing pretty much near a Pro Bowl caliber level, because everything was there. He had the strong side linebacker position covered. He was able to, you know, get to the quarterback, all those things. But all I know is that Irvin was able to parlay his deal into a nice $9 million salary, where Frank Clark is easily going to get $14 million, and I think they need to wrap him up with a contract sooner rather than later.
Because that's the part that I kind of go back and forth on, is that I think that Frank Clark, you can make a very compelling argument for re-signing him right now. But I also wonder, do you make that argument because the talent around him, because Seattle doesn't have as many great young players as they had at the time that they chose not to re-sign Bruce Irvin. And I guess I come back to that, because by the measure of, hey, Frank Clark is right now projected as a starting defensive end, they need him long-term, they don't have as many alternatives as they had back when Cliff Avril and Michael Bennett were there. But I also wonder if they just don't have the amount of talent that they used to have, and if you're extending Frank Clark, is that a bad sign? Because 4 years ago, you were deciding to make a decision like let Bruce Irvin walk. I love Bruce as a player, but I think that was the right decision. I think Seattle made the right decision, given the guys they had, that they couldn't afford to pay Bruce Irvin $9 million a year.
No question, because, I mean, as a linebacker, he was the third best linebacker. Again, very good, very talented. And it's funny because, I mean, you look at some of the guys that they had to let go, because, again, you can't keep everybody. If you're going to keep a core group of 7 Pro Bowl players on defense like they did, you know, you're going to have to let some guys go. And that's just the nature of things. But it's interesting to see that some of the guys that they've let go are still in. I mean, Bruce Irvin still playing at a high level. Russell Okung had a good season last year. Max Unger, at the age of 32, is out there still doing some good things. But, you know, you can't keep everybody. And if you're number 3 linebacker, it just doesn't fit at $9 million. But here's my rationale on Frank Clark. You know, if you don't do something, it's going to cost you probably $18 to $19 million next year. And I think you'd rather incorporate it. And because if you, you could even lose him, because if you don't franchise him, then now you've lost your top three pass rushers in over a course of 1 year, and you're really in a pickle because you definitely may not be able to have enough to try to replace him. So I think it's better served to get him done now because you know there's a defined number there. It's Dan, Danielle Hunter's $14.4 million contract, which of course came out is only 16.9 guaranteed, which is much better because, you know, if they need to, they can get out of it. I would rather pay the 14 plus change now, and if it doesn't work out, get out of the contract as opposed to waiting and then maybe not be able to sign him, have to franchise him, or possibly lose him.
Hey, John, new owner for the Carolina Panthers, of course, David Tepper. Is there a – I heard there's a statue somewhere in the stadium of Jerry Richardson. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah. Is that likely to stand? Because there were some pretty...
No, it's going to stand because one of the things that Jerry Richardson wanted written into the agreement on the sale is that it stays. And that's by contract. It has to stay. Oh, yeah, he wrote that into the contract. And you know, Dave Tepper, which I've got to get him on the podcast because he's a Pittsburgh guy. He was 4 years behind me. I mean, he started going to Pitt when I was getting out of Duquesne. So I think there's probably a good chance I get to know him pretty well. And I like what I see of him so far. One of the things, because he's the one who brought this up. I mean, it didn't have to come out. It's a big topic there because of Jerry Richardson and the legacy, kind of the lost legacy that he had, you know, with all the incidents in the office and that. And people wanted to take the statue down. Well, apparently, Jerry did not want that to happen, and I think it's a symbol to what he's been able to do for Charlotte, for getting that franchise, making it a good franchise, all the good things that he did for the area. The statue needs to stand. You got a lot of people in Charlotte saying, why do we have to keep the statue and look at this creepy old guy?
Yeah.
Hey, go Stanford.
Sorry, I was getting a Stanford hat here. I had to give him a go Stanford. Yeah.
Was that Richard Sherman?
He doesn't care for the dancing tree. Yeah. Danny, your microphone's off.
How about the band? You like the band? He likes the band.
He was in the band, Dave.
Were you a trombone player? What? Okay. All right. So, yeah, there's a guy from the Stanford band here. Hey, John, the one statue they do have there is Sam Mills. Last time we were there, I was sick as a dog. I got the flu or something. And I got a picture next to Sam Mills. That's one statue that I was like, okay, I got to get a picture next to that guy. He's a huge part of that franchise. And it's so weird because as a player, he was there, you know, a pretty good amount of time, but he hung around with that franchise. He means a lot to that franchise, doesn't he?
He really does, and I think that's one of the great things is that, and that's why I think that the statue of Jerry Richardson needs to continue standing. Because I mean, think about the loyalty that didn't necessarily have to happen with the people who played there. I mean, for example, Eugene Robinson stayed there. He's doing the color on the broadcast.
True.
I mean, you notice that so many of the other players, you know, they want to stay around there. And again, you figure, okay, it's Charlotte. Is that really where you want to spend the rest of your life? Well, apparently, you know, thanks to what Jerry's been able to set up in the organization and thanks to guys like Sam Mills and others, you know, they really have stayed there. And so, again, the legacy, though tarnished, of Jerry Richardson for what he's done for that community, I think is sensational.
How are the Panthers going to do this year, John?
I think they're going to drop down a little bit. I mean, there's, you know, a couple metric things that I look at. I mean, they had, and I call them net losses. When you lose, and this is, you know, the one run game theory in baseball, but if you lose by one possession or you win by one possession, you have a high net. If it's low 1 year, you're going to get better the next. And if it's going to be high, then you're going to go worse. And so they were 11-5, and they had a net seven games where they won by one possession or less. And so normally that should take you down to like 9. You know, their schedule is difficult because they're in a very difficult division. You know, they're trying to make transitions at wide receiver. That could be good. They've, you know, lost a couple of games, got a little bit of age in the defense now. So, I think they're going to drop down. I think, you know, I would put Carolina pretty much in the same area as Seattle. I mean, a team that, you know, probably should win 9, might have a chance to 10, but I think that, you know, Carolina could actually drop a little bit below Seattle.
That would be a puzzling. They're a tough team to make sense of because they obviously have a quarterback that's able to lead them, and I mean, Cam Newton is one of the primetime players. Ron Rivera is a pretty established coach, but it seems like they have some volatility from year to year where they're an every other year kind of contending team.
Exactly. And I think that, I mean, you can see they won 11 games and they had, you know, really, they didn't have a great year offensively. They fired their offensive coordinator, Mike Shula, you know, and they've changed it and gone to North Turner. They've never been able to get 60% completions out of Cam Newton, as talented as he is. And you know, when he had the MVP season, you know, I had him now moving ahead of Russell Wilson at that one year as the fourth or fifth best quarterback in the league. I mean, really, what I kind of do is I leave that number four spot for the MVP, unless it's going to be Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady, or Ben Roethlisberger. And so, like, Matt Ryan won MVP, so I put him right ahead of Russell Wilson. And Russell Wilson had MVP, you know, three quarters of the season last year. But, you know, Cam still hasn't gotten the most out of what he can do, and North Turner is going to try to do it. You know, the running game was a mess. They didn't get as much out of that as they could, even though they drafted Christian McCaffrey and had Jonathan Stewart. They have a good offensive line, but they end up losing Andrew Norwell. They were very slow at wide receiver. So, you know, they've got some work to do on offense. And you're right, the volatility is there, and they are. Like, you know, they'll go to the Super Bowl at 15-1 and have a great season like that and then come back and not make the playoffs at 7-9.
John, Josh McCown, you hear what he had to say about Sam Darnold?
Yeah, he likes him.
Yeah, he called him the right guy. He called him the right guy. Sam Darnold, how long until we see him under center there in New York?
I mean, if McCown keeps them, you know, to a 6-7 win season, you may not see him until December because I don't think they want to rush him. If they get off to some kind of a bad start, which is always possible, I think they're getting better. Their secondary has improved dramatically. You know, they're starting to get some good draft choices in there. Still don't have much at wide receiver, and I'm suspect on their running game. But, you know, I think that you know, you probably see him by November at the earliest.
That shows why McCown's the right guy for that job, though, right? Instead of sitting there and saying, yeah, this young whippersnapper's got nothing on me. Like you said, they're talking about, they've definitely got the right guy there. Oh, yeah. You
I'm
know
the wrong guy.
I'm he's chopped liver. I'm just flatter, here keeping sure a spot warm. Until
you know,
he's
a beta male.
Yeah, he is.
He totally is a beta male. Like he's Charlie Whitehurst.
I'll tell you what, though. That's the right. If you're looking at how do I stay employed here for 2 years as opposed to how do I just stay employed here for 1 year, that's the right answer.
I don't think so. I'm sorry. I'm going to disagree. Josh McCown, I like. He's the one that signed his contract in the drive-through lane.
Yes.
Isn't that right? I mean, you got to have mm-hmm. that fight in that you think, you know, you think that, and I'm not talking about being delusional like the king. I mean, you got to have that fight that you still think that you can play. I'm not sure if I would want that.
Sometimes it's just good enough.
Well, think about how smart he was and how good he was for the team. Because again, that's what I like about taking comparables. Because here's Ryan Fitzpatrick. He went to Harvard. He was negotiating with the Jets, and he was more worried about getting a 2-year contract at about $14 million a year. And he missed all the OTAs and the mini camp and all that stuff. And he ended up getting a deal, wasn't what exactly he wanted. And then he had such a bad start, he ends up getting cut the next year. Well, here's McCown. It's like, hey, I'm a backup quarterback, and you're going to pay me 2 years, $20 million? It's like, great, let's do it. If I get cut in 1 year, fine, I'm 38. So, he's a good leader. I mean, he's a good athlete. I mean, he was always a great athlete when he started out in Arizona, and now he goes in with the right attitude, and it's like, hey, let's take this young whippersnapper and get him ready, and I'll go into the sunset.
All right, John, we always appreciate it here on 710 Day. We're really glad you joined us. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you.
That is the Professor John Clayton. You can hear him each morning, Brock and Salk, 7:15, then on his show from 10 to noon, the Cold Hard Facts brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light. If you missed any of it, you can download the podcast right now, 710sports.com. We've got Mike Marjama, a premature end to his baseball career for what he feels is a higher calling. We're going to talk to him about that decision next.
Day live from Druid's Glen Golf Course, this is Danny, Dave, and Moore.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Happy Hour brought to you by Heritage Distillings, BSB, Brown Sugar Bourbon, just underway here. We got groups moving through here. It's 710 Day at Druid's Glen, $7.10 for a round of golf opportunity. It's about as good as it gets for people who are out here playing. We're trying to get Mark Marjama on the phone to talk about his decision to step away from baseball, to retire from baseball and pursue a role, a job with the National an Association for Eating Disorders. We'll talk to him about that. The other thing is, and we brought this up about who do you want to win, the Astros or the A's? And I think it says more about how you feel about the Mariners than it does really about either the strategy involved or anything. Like, do you want to see them try to shoot the moon? Or are you looking for the safest way to get into any postseason game? Because the safest way,
the game of the Queen of Spades where you're trying to get the Queen of Spades?
That's correct.
In a game of hearts?
Yeah. Where you make
I don't play hearts. I always play spades.
Yeah, spades is a different game. Hearts, you can make the decision to try and get all the hearts. And if you get all the hearts, you stick everybody else with a massive amount of points.
But you got to get the Queen of Spades.
You got to get
too.
Them all, and that includes the Queen of Spades.
Yeah.
And if
they're
just
and
one
she's
heart,
worth 13.
Yes. And if you end up with not getting, if you end up with not getting it, you're going to eat like 20, 21, 22 hearts. But if you get it, like the reward is so outrageously high that sometimes you'll say it's worth the risk, but it never works. Like my cousin Chris, that always goes to try to shoot the moon. Like, I would say that his batting average is about 160 when he hits it. But when he hits it, I mean, it's Mike Zunino, long shot, gone.
Well, okay, logically, like, I like that you and Dave think that the Mariners can do this and beat the Astros and win the West. But, like, if you were an odds maker in Las Vegas, what would you say it would be? You think it's like 20-1 that they'd beat the Astros, 10-1, 5-1?
I think it's 10-1. I think I would give them. Yeah.
10 to 1 horses win a lot.
10 to 15%. I would think that if you looked at the likelihood that the Mariners right now, they're 3 games back, and they've what, still got 9 games against the Astros?
No, I think they have more than that. I think they played them, what? They played them 6 times. I think 13.
13
usually they play
13
19.
More. Like, I would say there's a solid 10 to 15% chance. Like, even considering the talent disparity, and look, Houston's starting rotation is better. Their offense is better. The one advantage the Mariners have is the bullpen. I think the Mariners' bullpen, especially with Colomé looking like he has recently, that's the one area where I would say, hey, I'd rather have the Mariners' bullpen than the Astros. But both their lineup and their starting rotation, I think clear advantage to Houston.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, too, isn't it, Dave, where you sit there and as much as the one-game playoff I'd be fine with, but if you're facing Chris Sale in that one-game playoff, it can be over in a hurry.
I'd just charge the mound and take him out, Jim. That'd be the end of the game.
Do you think that you could throw Chris Sale 100 miles an hour? Like, Chris Sale might be able to throw a baseball 100 miles an hour, but you could throw Chris Sale?
No, I don't think 100 miles an hour, Danny. I have updated odds right here, okay?
Oh,
Houston Astros minus 450 to win AL West. Seattle Mariners plus 450.
So that means
that's it? Just 4.5 to 1?
Yeah.
Wow.
I was surprised by that. See, Danny and I are right.
Yeah.
Much more of a shot that it's there.
I'm wrong.
I just think it has to be. I mean, it's a special year already, but it's got to be an incredibly special year. And I think it's not just that the Mariners, it's not anything they can do in order to win the division. It's got to be Houston's got to get injuries or something's got to happen to them. So
you just look at the run differential. And it's more than the games at this point. I mean, the run differential would tell you that Houston has been a significantly better team, has performed more than just 3 games better than Seattle over the course of the season so far, and that over a longer season, you would tend to expect that Houston will continue to pull away. So, but I also look at it and say this, that with the A's and the Astros, I think it's more likely that the Mariners catch the Astros than the A's catch the Mariners, which is why I'm rooting for the A's to beat Houston. Because while a Houston sweep would derail any momentum and put more distance between the Mariners and the A's, that would help prevent the A's from being able to catch you from behind. I think that the upside of potentially, I think it's more likely that the Mariners would catch the Astros than the A's would catch them from behind. So therefore, I would go with the approach of, like, I want to see the A's win all these games. They won last night, and I want to see them continue to win during this 4-game series.
What about splitting the difference? They go 2-2, you get the best of both worlds.
Do you get the best of both worlds?
You don't get too much one way or too much the other way. Just looking at the run differential here, you know Oakland's ahead of Seattle in run differential.
Yeah.
Only by 2 runs, plus 19 to plus 17. And then the Astros running away with the whole thing. They're plus 186.
Good night.
That's incredible.
Well, and Boston and New York are the same, 154, 123 at this point. It's pretty amazing what they're doing. But, yeah, I just think it's been timely for the Mariners. They're creeping up there, right? Last time we talked about this, weren't they like plus 7 or plus 8? So slowly creeping up there with those one-run games.
See what they're able to do. The fact that Seattle is so good in close games, though, that's not an accident. I think that's a reflection of Edwin Diaz, and that's the reason Edwin Diaz is an all-star. Like, the fact, and all of the different talk about, oh, the run differential and what it means that the Mariners are really good in tight games. Like, I don't think that that is entirely luck. I don't think that that is, hey, you eventually have, you can be built better for close games. And I think the Mariners, their ability to hit fastballs and the length of their lineup that are there. We do have Mike Marjama joining us now, and Mike is on the Venue Kings hotline. Mike, we really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, no problem, guys. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
What? This had to be a tough decision for you, or maybe it wasn't that difficult. Tell us about your decision to retire from baseball to pursue a job and a cause that obviously is very close to your heart in terms of eating disorders.
Yeah, you know, I think where things have gone, especially, you know, within the media, a little bit maybe off. 100% in terms of everything that's been covered. You know, for me, this hasn't been just an overnight decision. It wasn't something that just happened in a, you know, spur of the moment. It's something that's kind of been progressing really throughout my whole entire life and career, you know, the way I like to think about it. I'm formally not taking a full-time employment with the National Eating Disorder Association, you know, but I am volunteering my time for them as an ambassador. That came about after I did that short documentary with LeBron James's media company Uninterrupted, right before spring training. And, this has kind of been on the table now for a few weeks. And a lot of opportunities for me to travel around and do some work, you know, helping their organization. But a lot of it was really the everyday, day-to-day grind, as well. So, although that is definitely a very big factor in the decision, it wasn't all of it.
Yeah, Mike, tell us a little bit about now. You said you are going to be traveling around, but do you have any idea of what kind of sort of interaction are you going to have with people? Is it going to be mostly going to high schools, kids? What's that going to look like once you get started?
Yeah, so I'll be going around speaking at local, you know, first of all, at local places, treatment centers, but also to various treatment centers around the country, kind of just talking with kids and more or less just being really an ambassador for what, you know, eating disorder recovery can be. So that will be happening. You know, for me, a great story would be in Tacoma, just about a few weeks ago, I went to a movie down in Point Rustin, and one of the guys in the movie theaters was an employee there, and I got there about half hour before the movie started, and a young kid ran up to me and said, you know, are you Mike Marjama? And I was like, yeah. I was like, you know, hey, how are you doing? And he goes, hey, and introduced himself, talked about how he was a baseball player and coming up, and, you know, he asked if he could ask me some questions sometime. I said, yeah, you know, by all means, ask me anything you want. And I said, you know what, we got 20 minutes here, why don't you sit down? So he grabbed a seat, and for 20 minutes, we got to talk about just things in life for him. And the things that really stood out for me is he wanted to talk to me about baseball, but he really noted at the things that I was doing on maybe social media, those things where he goes, you know what, you've really resonated with me beyond being an athlete, and I really appreciate that. And so for a young kid to be able to say that and show that, you know, he really appreciates that, you know, you can open up and just, we all have a story. And, you know, that really stuck with me. So I look forward to connecting with kids, you know, more on that level coming up here in the near future.
So, Mike, you're the starting catcher for the Mariners on opening day. I'm just curious why you made this decision in the middle of the season.
Well, it's been a long decision process. We'll say it that way. This isn't something that, like I said, just happened overnight. You know, this is even dating back to, you know, the past few years. Of really enjoying the game. And, I'll say it this way. When you kind of lose a passion, maybe not a passion, I still love the game, but it's hard going every single day to the ballpark and not feeling like that's where you're meant to be. And knowing that, you're not really fully enjoying it. So for the past really the past few months, even in the major leagues, I didn't know if I really fully enjoyed it. I remember not being able to go out. I kind of shut my family out, shut friends out, shut significant others out. So where I was going and who I was becoming wasn't someone I was very happy to be. And, you know, I have very strong in my faith. And over the past few months, I've really been praying about it. And finally came to a point where with a concussion and dealing with that for a few weeks, and then really the day before I'm supposed to come back from that, I have a very random back injury trying to get ready to come back. And really my body wasn't responding. And I, during that time of the deal, I had some time to think. And more or less, the more I prayed, the more I thought, you know what, this is the time. And, you know, I decided with all these great opportunities at my feet and, you know, really all these things that were left in front of me, it was a good time to just say, you know what, this, you know, this is it. And I got to walk out on my own terms. And, you know, I know that's something that we all as athletes really wish we could have. And I'm very fortunate to be able to have done that.
Tell you what, Mike, that's really courageous on your part. I thought that when you talked about the eating disorders and were part of the documentary film that you mentioned. And I think that now to pursue what you feel most passionate about. I think that takes a lot of courage to do that and to step away. I know we enjoyed talking to you last season after you're coming up to the major leagues, and we're going to be watching what you continue to do. We appreciate you joining us to talk about that and being so open about it. We really do appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thanks, guys. I really appreciate you having me.
All right. That is
Mike.
That is Mike Marjama. We're going to sweep the Dow. That's coming up next.
Celebrating 710 Day live from Druids Glen Golf Course. This is Danny, Dave, and Moore.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com. Sweeping the Dial. Streaming everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app and 710sports.com.
Breaking news.
And we do have breaking news at this hour of the best possible variety to bring to you. All 12 boys, every child from that soccer team has been rescued from that flooded cave in Thailand after 18 days.
It's an amazing story with a very happy ending. I mean, there was one diver who had died several days ago in preparing for this rescue, but all 12 of those boys taken out of what was an incredibly dangerous, a cave that had flooded on a hike that went into there. Really, really remarkable, and thankfully that they were saved.
Yeah, that's how scary and what a sad, crazy story that was. But did you follow it much on TV?
I did. I did mostly because my father-in-law loves BBC.
Yeah.
And we kept watching BBC, and they would continue to show the footage of it and exactly how difficult it was. And I think that's when I gained a real appreciation. Honestly, when I first heard they were found in the cave, yeah, I was like, oh, they'll be able to get them out easy now. Like, everybody knows where they are, and the world's a pretty remarkable place with technology. And it was only after hearing it, like it was a Thai Navy SEAL, like a guy who was at their elite military unit, and he was retired, died as if they were preparing for it. I mean, that's, and you realize, like, oh my God, like, that's it. It would be worse to know where they are and be unable to get them out.
Yeah, and how frustrating would that have been, and just sad to if they couldn't have been able to do it. But you're right. I mean, on the surface, you just think, well, drill a hole. We have the technology to get this done. But it was a lot more difficult than that.
No, it's just, it really is amazing, because I was reading the stories every day, and to hear about the labyrinth down there and the no visibility, the muddy water, all the different things. There were areas in there where the channel was just 2 feet wide, and then you're dealing with kids that can't even swim, much less know how to dive. And it was just, to hear that news today that all those kids got out of there, and then their coach was the last one out, so it was just fantastic. Okay.
I'm going to sound like Bill Walton here. You guys ever been in a cave?
I've seen a live volcano.
Yeah. I've spelunked before. The lava beds in Tule Lake, there were like cave formations that you could go climb around in outside of Klamath Falls, a little bit south in Northern California. It's freaky. Like, yeah, you had water that? An underwater cave? It's terrifying.
Listen here, brother. It's us, BB. You're probably thinking of the other BB who goes by the name of Brandon Belt. But let me tell you something, brother. We're the Ballot Brothers!
The Ballot Brothers!
We need all of you right now to get up out of your seats. Right now! Pull out your cell phones and start casting your votes for the undisputed, supreme, reigning, defending Brandon Belt, the best-looking guy there is out there. And let me tell you something. We got to get him to D.C. And without you, we need your cell phones involved. You got to get on there, and you got to vote.
Pretty good. Macho Man. Was it Macho Man? Was it Hulk? It was a little merger of the two, between the two of them talking about that. It was Hunter Pence, and what was the other chucklehead from San Francisco who were...
Derek Holland.
Yeah.
Derek Holland.
Derek Holland. You remember we talked to Dutch?
We did.
We talked to Derek Holland out in the outfield.
You know what we talked to him about?
Chris Sale. Yeah.
Yeah, and he said, he's a good dude. I don't think I said I was going to whoop him or anything, but I just said that, you know, we said, what about the scissors? How about him cutting up those jerseys?
And that's when Holland was like, those jerseys were bad.
Yeah. Yeah, and he was a nice guy. But this is funny, and I like that they coordinated with I didn't think the Jean Belt thing was that funny yesterday when we talked about it, but it's working, apparently. Is Belt also... Is he getting the
Belt
same kind of response?
Second in the National League behind Jesus Aguilar.
So the Gene Belt combination has worked. What would be some other Gene combinations? If there had been a guy named Jacket, you could have Gene Jacket.
Gene, you said Poole earlier.
Gene Poole.
And it would say it was Steve Poole.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Our friend Steve Poole.
Yeah. And get Gene into the Cigarra. Gene Poole.
No, Danny, you're in charge of coming up with corny things. So. Yeah. Don't ask Gemini for this.
Oh, no.
That's your department.
You don't want
to
be
I'm trying to work denim, Canadian tuxedo. I'm just kind of throwing things up.
Well, wouldn't Gene Segura and James Paxton combine to be the Canadian tuxedo?
I could see that. But or you could have maple jeans.
Thanks for the help.
Yeah, Danny is starting to rub off on C-Raj in a really bad way. Yeah. A really bad way.
I liked when Jim was. I was thinking denim. I was thinking. It's like, Jim, you have to have the word gene involved.
No, I know. I was. Well,
that's,
I was trying to be,
the
you know,
key, that's
you
the
guys
key
don't understand
what
I'm trying to be a good teammate. You know, you should say, well, okay, Jim, that's a little outside of what we're looking for, but appreciate the effort. But no, just rip me.
That's kind of what Danny did do.
Swing at the ankles.
Cano and Segura could be relaxed jeans.
Loose fit.
I'm worried about you, C-Rod. I'm really, really worried about you.
That's Swoop of the Downs brought to you by Specialty Insulation, and it wraps up our happy hour, which is brought to you by Heritage Distilling's BSB, Brown Sugar Bourbon. We got two tickets to give away. We're going to give you the key to doing that next.